16. Captain Thelenia was sitting in her cabin reading and drinking kava when she heard the sound of booted feet on the gangplank. They carried the rushed sound of running, and she was up in a flash, one hand casually checking the blade at her hip. When she opened the door, Irithella Thleolon stood there, his face grim. His blade was drawn, and he watched the sky, not her. "What happened?" she asked. He looked back and seemed to catch himself. His pale green skin was flushed with effort.
"Stress reaction resulting in brief hyper-awareness and imminent exhaustion," he said,
and she saw the look in his eyes that no human would understand, the way they tracked the light. He had been around crystals, and they had weakened his soul.
"Sorry," he said, and took several deep breaths. "Presence of crystal technology, discomforting but temporary. New information suggesting identity of those responsible for the attack on the dragon."
She cursed quietly.
"Who?"
He smiled bitterly, and when he spoke again, his soul had returned, unblemished by the touch of magic.
"Your fears were well-founded. He was taken down by someone attempting to gain favor with the ancients. Who else knew that you were bringing Locke here?"
Thelenia frowned.
"No one, and my crew have flown with me for years." "Are you certain?" Irithella Fleolon asked urgently. "Check your messenger spore."
She was turning to do it, caught by his urgency, when the insult of the command struck her, and she remembered Irithella Fleolon giving commands during the card tournament she had hosted, the grave offence and scandal of it. For one second she fought the alarm, telling herself that it was because he travelled outside the Elfland so often that he had lost his way. Then the alarm took over, years of trusting her instincts, and her hand went to her blade as she turned back to him. His own blade slid across her throat as she turned.
"I am sorry," he said,
and as she clutched at her throat, he grabbed her shoulder and put the blade through her heart. The small sitting room held Westyke and three paladins in their black coats. In Locke's mind, she thought of them as left, right, and centre. Centre was next to Westyke, right stood in front of a bookshelf, and left stood behind a table.
"It's a Facera de Lockenville," Westyke said with a smug smile. "What a ple—"
She came into the room at a run, and the smug paladins fumbled with their bands as she was suddenly in their midst. She lunged at Westyke with a leap that drove her forearm into his throat and her knee into his crotch and slammed him into the back wall. As he crumpled, she shoved him into centre, sending both men sprawling. She leaped at Wright as he brought his band up to fire, knocking his arm wide. A flare of crimson energy flashed out past her and slammed into left. She heard him grunt as he hit the far wall. She had Wright's arm and momentum, and she went for the break, but Wright saw it coming and tucked his arm back to take the blow on the forearm. It left him open, and Locke put a fist into his throat, slammed the heel of her palm into his temple, and then smashed his head into the bookshelf as he reeled. Centre was up, band coming up to fire as he shoved Westyke aside, and Locke dove at him and got her left arm up to slap his shot wide. Crimson energy flashed past her, and she thought it hit left again, but didn't have time to look, because her desperate lunge had left her off balance. She tossed a jab at Centre's head, but he caught it with a boxer's guard, and countered with a jab that jolted its way down her spine, even as she leaned in to take it on the forehead instead of the nose. As she staggered, he came in with a low right hook that hit with bruising force even as she caught it on her arm, and then a high right that she ducked under. She felt the kick coming and tried to take it on the hip rather than the gut, but it still hit with crushing power that drove her to her knees. Centre's fist rained down once, then twice, and Locke kept her guard up against the battering storm, arms high to protect her head. She felt him shift again, saw his knee coming in to smash her face, and this time caught the blow, smothered it, and shoved his leg aside. As he wavered, off balance for an instant, she drove her fist into his crotch. Centre staggered. Locke grabbed his shoulder and hauled down as she punched up. She felt bone under the heel of her palm and heard that little click as his jaw snapped shut from the blow, and Centre went down bonelessly as Locke spun. Left was halfway back to his feet, leaning on the card table. Locke stepped forward and kicked the table, driving it into him and him into the wall. She heard ribs crack and saw his face turn ashen as he hung, pinned to the wall. She stepped past the table and put him out with a clean blow to the temple. "See, Westyke," she said, still breathing hard to the groaning man. "What you had was an ambush, and the thing about ambushing someone is that you don't talk to them first." He was on his hands and knees, and it wouldn't be fair to kick him. But the ancients had bands that shot blasts of energy, and Locke wasn't entirely sure Westyke didn't have one, so she kicked him once across the jaw to make sure he stayed down. Then Locke turned back to the hallway. It was empty, with no sign of Naria. Locke raised her fists. "Naria, last time you came at me, I took you down and broke your lenses. You want a rematch? Take your best shot. But I'm not leaving without that fancy crystal airship you used as first blade." The words hung in the air for a moment, and Locke felt the slow ache in her arms and hip, as well as at the base of her skull where the jab had rattled her. The air shimmered, and Naria appeared, crouched where she'd been standing before. "You came here for my wing," Naria smiled bitterly. "Of course you did. You would only show up if you wanted something." Locke lowered her fists. "I had dangerous people after me. I didn't want to bring that home."
"And then you needed something," Naria said.
"And you did." She looked at the fallen ancients and Westyke.
"They knew you were coming. They threatened me and my people unless I helped them. All because you wanted my wing."
Locke shook her head. "You'd be a dangerous woman, Naria, if you had the guts to take shots at anyone besides me." Naria's mouth twisted into angry words that she swallowed instead of saying. She reached into a hidden pocket of her fine orange gown and drew out a glossy black crystal no larger than Locke's palm.
"The field past the water garden," she said. "The key will bring it down from the sky and make it visible."
She tossed Locke the key.
"Never come back here."
"Deal." Locke stepped out of the sitting room. She brushed Naria's shoulder as she walked by. Naria didn't turn as Locke walked away. There were worse places to wait for Locke to fight things out with her sister, Kale decided, than on a comfortable bench in the Lockenville Estate's water garden, with a beautiful woman beside him. The beautiful woman was a death priestess, and that still threw him off from time to time. But the good thing about working for Locke was that he'd learned that there were lots of things worse than death priestesses. That was also the bad thing about working for Locke, Kale decided, and sighed, looking at the white and purple flowers floating on the lily pads.
"What are you thinking?" Desidora asked, leaning into him a little. She didn't curl her arm around his. Something about it, someone doing anything close to grappling with him, made his mind go to that dark little corner where Archvoyant Celestin's magic had wrapped around his soul and turned him into a helpless puppet. Some women would have gotten angry when he tensed up and pulled away, taking it as an insult or a sign that he didn't care. Desidora was a love priestess, though, at least when she didn't have her death powers turned on to make zombies, and she had a pretty good idea of how people worked. So she leaned into him instead of curling her arm around his. He put his arm around her waist.
"The usual," he said, and she nodded, her auburn hair brushing against his cheek. Her hair smelled warm and mysterious, at least when it was red instead of pitch black.
"Celestin was bad, and he came after us hard, but he didn't hit us where we lived."
"I'm glad your mother is safe."
"I think I saved the ancients from her more than the other way around," Kale said, and grinned. "My mum will take anybody who gets up in her face."
Desidora shuddered, and at first Kale thought she was sad, and then cold. After a moment, he realized that she was trying to hold in a laugh.
"Diz? Diz?"
"You," she gasped, still trying not to laugh. "You say all these things about people as mothers, and then you say that about yours, and I'm not supposed to think anything."
Kale sat back and fixed Desidora with a stare.
"Diz, you're not thinking rude things about my mum."
Her eyes wide and innocent and maybe watering a bit from laughter, she nodded.
"I would never do that."
"My mother is a nice, respectable lady," Kale said firmly. "And..."
"No, damn it, don't start laughing again."
The damn water clock emptied a great wave of water behind them, and Kale jumped and swore, and Desidora leaned over, giggling hysterically. And then Tala staggered out of the manor, one hand pressed to her side and leg dragging behind her, and shouted,
"Run!"
A crimson blast of energy slammed into her from behind, and she sailed down the stairs, hit the marble stones of the yard below hard, and didn't move.
Ben Kodar's hell, Kale muttered.
Kun Kamni Altosifuris,
came a cry from the manor, and beside Kale, Desidora went cold, literally.
You can say that again, she said as her hair went black and her skin went pale.
Gil's power came out of the manor in the grip of former Archvoyant Bertram, with a pair of paladins flanking him. Technically, the ancients had also enslaved the nobles who had put on the paladin bands, but the nobles had on some level been trying to seize power, and Kale could see his way to letting that lie. Bertram, well, he was learned, and he was old money, and he was probably not less corrupt than most of the Voyants. But he hadn't been aiming for war when Kale had seen him up on Heaven's Spire, locked in place with tendrils of crystal jabbed into his fingers. He'd been a man trying to do the right thing, his body and mind shackled by magic.
"Can you break Gil's hold on Bertram?" Kale asked as he got to his feet.
Tessadora flung out a hand as Gil's power and the paladins leaped down the stairs and came at them. Bertram flinched, reeling in place, and then recovered and kept coming.
"Shielded," Desidora hissed. "But are they all shielded?"
She raised both hands this time, and something in her stance told Kale that she wasn't trying to free the nobles from their paladin bands. Both of the paladins paused as Desidora's magic hit. Then they smiled, raised their arms, and unleashed blasts of crimson light. Kale saw it coming and dove from the little platform, rolling as he landed on a wooden bridge. He heard the other blast hit Desidora, who splashed into the water behind him.
"The Death Priestess," one of the paladins called out. "See how she twists the very essence of magic with her unholy power? If only we had wards that could prevent her from draining the life from us, she would, some pathetic sack of meat," said the other. "Ah, wait, we do. Mr. Lively sends his regards."
He turned to Kale, who hadn't stopped running, and raised his band again.
"Which one is this?"
Kale reached another platform and ducked behind the vine-wrapped marble column that rose from it, as blasts of energy cracked and hissed around him.
"Oh, of course," cried the first one. "Benjamet du Quail, the petty thief whose mother we arrested."
More blasts of energy flashed past, and Kale hunkered down. The blast sizzled as they hit the water, and fish bobbed to the surface, floating belly up.
"Does this Benjamet have any powers I should be worried about?" said the second one.
He was moving, his steps light but audible on one of the wooden bridges. Kale looked over, saw him come into view on one side, flanking him, and dove into the water. He realized quickly that the water was only waist high and pulled himself along the bottom more than swam. He heard a froth of bubbles behind him as the blast hit where he had been, and the water near his feet burned for a moment. He wanted to come up for air, but pulled himself along slowly instead. Splashing would tell them where he was, but the pool was filled with lily pads and fish and flowers and crap, and if he moved slowly, he thought it possible that he might not die immediately. Blast struck the water a ways away, and then off in the other direction, hissing and bubbling. Kale pinched his nose, looked up, and aimed for a patch of darkness as he came up as quietly as he could, lungs burning. He was under one of the wooden bridges, which arched just enough to give him room to get his head out of the water.
"Where are you, little man?" called the first paladin from right over his head. "Your file doesn't say anything about breathing underwater, so you must be here somewhere." "His file doesn't say much of anything," the other paladin called back from behind one of the marble pillars,
and Kale heard the sound of a blast hitting the water again.
"No magic. The Silkworth girl is better with locks and has alchemical training. I suppose Lochinville keeps him around out of sentiment."
"Kun Kamni Altosifuris,"
Gil's power shouted again. And above his head, Kale heard the first ancient sigh.
"We're not going to kill you," the paladin called out begrudgingly,
and sent another blast of crimson into the water, frying some lily pads and sending more fish to the surface.
"But if I have to get wet searching, you're not going to be happy when I find you."
Kale reached up, grabbed his ankle, and pulled hard. The paladin fell, and Kale lunged onto the bridge on top of him. He got in two good punches before the paladin got in a kick that flung Kale away, and the scout got back to his feet to see the paladin coming at him, grinning broadly, black coat flaring dramatically.
"Oh, look at you fighting."
"Yeah, look at me," Kale said, and came in swinging.
The paladin blocked one punch, stepped away from a second, and spun into a kick that caught Kale in the chest and flung him across the bridge and onto the platform at the other side. He hit the marble, rolled into the column hard enough to bounce off, and sent a lovely reading chair toppling into the pool as he slammed into it.
"Shall I?" the other paladin called,
and Kale looked over to see that the man had his arm raised, pointed dead on target.
"Don't strain yourself."
The first paladin walked lightly across the bridge, still grinning.
"He's weak enough that you might accidentally kill him, and Commander Gillespie wants him alive."
He cracked his knuckles.
"You see, little man, this is for your own good."
"Uh-huh." Kale looked past him at Bertram, who had crossed a bridge onto one of the platforms. He held Gillespie up high, as though lifting the weapon for a better view. Kale could see the memory of his own eyes in Bertram's.
"Gillespie wants me alive, huh? Why's that? Is his mother lonely?"
He jerked his chin at Gillespie.
"Listen, Gil, she can't be that lonely, because when I went to her place last night, there was a line out round the corner."
"Kutasoshka Terris!"
Gillespie yelled, and Bertram flung the mighty warhammer. Kale was in the water before it even left Bertram's hand. He dove, came up, heard the warhammer hit the marble column and shatter it, and saw the arsehole paladin's smug expression wiped off his face as a bunch of shattered rock came down on top of him. But Kale only gave it a glance because he was pulling himself out of the water, rolling back onto a bridge just as a crimson flash of light ripped into the pool where he'd been, killing even more poor fish. Then Kale was up, running over the bridge, to the platform, to the next bridge, and then to the platform where Bertram still stood. The former Archvoyant had not moved from his throw. He stood like a statue or a broken puppet, arm extended, hand open.
"Bertram!" Kale yelled. "Bertram!"
He reached the man, the poor broken man with the tortured eyes, and slapped his hand shut.
"Bertram! He's not in your hand! He's not in your hand!"
Kale pushed the man's hand into a fist, his dark hands holding Bertram's shut.
"He's not here!"
Bertram blinked. He looked at his hand.
I...
Kale met his eyes, and Bertram sagged and fell into him, arms going taut around him. Kale wanted to flinch and pull away, but some things were more important. He was interrupted by mocking laughter, and he turned to see the other ancient.
"Was this your plan?"
the paladin said as he crossed a bridge, arm trained on Kale.
"Maybe there's a reason they keep me around after all, huh?" Kale called back.
"A clever tongue."
The paladin shook his head.
"A witty slave is more trouble than he's worth."
"You're right,"
Kale said, and gently pushed Bertram behind him. He looked down. Bertram's hands were squeezed shut of their own volition now, and with a smile, Kale turned back to the paladin.
"And I sure as Bin Kodar's hell can't fight you. But you know, you've overlooked two things that really should have been in that file of yours."
The paladin stepped onto a bridge, still smiling.
"And those are?"
"First off," Kale said, "you don't want to go after a lady who manipulates magical energy with magical energy, because that's probably just going to piss her off.